On October 13, 2005, a discussion on the role of aid was held at the University of Winnipeg. The main focus was humanitarian organizations in war-torn countries and their work. The guest speakers included Major Harry Chadwick from the Canadian Forces, who served since 1987 and whose services included two deployments in Bosnia, where he was involved with humanitarian work of various kinds.
From the Canadian Forces perspective, in the last 10 years, we began to focus on what we call the three-block war, or full-spectrum operations.
Tony Palmer, director of Medicine Sans Frontières Canada, who started working for them in 1998 and has been the head of mission in Northern Sudan, and who worked as an emergency advisor during the Southern African nutritional crisis.
I don't think our response to conflict has changed any over the last decade. We still, our primary aim is still to preserve life and alleviate suffering, and we do that through the provision primarily of medical assistance.
Peter Dula, Mennonite Central Committee's Iraq coordinator, who served with the Mennonite Central Committee in Burundi and has a PhD in theology from Duke University.
What happens then is that once those lines become confused, humanitarians become legitimate targets.
James Oporia Ekwaro, coordinator of Sudan Folk Point Africa, a group involved in helping churches to think about post-war reconstruction and nation building.
The war was seen as just, both by those who were theologians or Christians, but also international law.
In this part, we're going to talk about how humanitarian agencies respond to rebel groups that create humanitarian victims to further their agenda, and about sharing information between humanitarian organizations and the military. It is known that some rebel groups have in the past created humanitarian victims to further their agenda. Therefore, the question that was asked was how the represented agencies responded to that and whether or not they have a guideline that has been put in place to prevent these kinds of incidences.
We'd all be naive if we thought that there wasn't those who would try to manipulate for their own benefit humanitarian aid or what that brings. But I think I can only speak for the agency that I work with, MSF. Basically, it comes down to trying to have an understanding of the context. And basically, we, like I said, it gets back down to needs. And sometimes, I'll fully admit, we don't go back the chain of events all the way back to see what happened. We're not necessarily good or have the expertise to do that. But if there is a famine going on, we respond with a nutritional program. If there is an epidemic breaking out, we respond with the appropriate medical program. And are there those who may have manipulated that in the past? Of course, and we've left countries because of it. Ethiopia, we were kicked out in 1984 because we thought the movement of the population contributed or was feeding the famine in some regards type thing. So we're also quite open to being quite vocal in terms of when we think there is manipulation going on, but at the same time, I don't know if you can ever guarantee everybody that you aren't being manipulated, because there's many factors and forces at work. And you know, as we as MSF, we do not consider ourselves an institution by any means. We are a movement of volunteers, basically. And so surely we are not experts in the finer points of some of the things that are going on, nor should we.
With us, we absolutely accept, like I said, that we absolutely accept that we need to allow that humanitarian space. Maybe it's an overused term, but so we will change our ways within reason to allow the humanitarian space to work. We do that by facilitating where possible, but primarily by just allowing the aid agencies to do what they do best. There will be situations where the military, we need to do humanitarian assistance. They are very few and far between. The situation where we are the only option, I think everyone accepts that some humanitarian assistance provided by a military organization maybe better. But certainly, we believe, from a military standpoint, we believe that fisheries would support that. But those situations are very few and far between. The military are not the best people at delivering aid. They're normally not the appropriate people to deliver aid. But occasionally, we could be the only people. The military is the only organization that has helicopters in any appreciable numbers. So the U.S. Central Command is prosecuting the war in Afghanistan. They have enough helicopters that they are now supporting a humanitarian disaster in Pakistan. Now, that's an example where it's an acceptable use of military resources for humanitarian assistance operations from our standpoint. Now, we try to follow the military civil defense assets agreements that when we do humanitarian assistance, it's unarmed. Our helicopters should not be armed. If we devote them to humanitarian assistance operations, like in the floods in Guyana and Jamaica and Haiti last year, our helicopters from a peacekeeping mission are immediately dispatched to humanitarian assistance operation, but the weapons were taken off them and they are conducting humanitarian assistance. So there are times when we'll do it. I would want to respond to this idea that we're part of an occupying force in Afghanistan. We really, in the civic world and in the military at large, we like to believe that we operate with the consent of the people in Afghanistan. We have approximately 6,000 NATO troops in Afghanistan that we hope will grow to 10,000. Any student of the history of Afghanistan will tell you, if the Afghan people want us to leave, we are going to leave very quickly. Down the same road that our grandfathers got out of Afghanistan, I think. The Soviet Union did not have the will of the people in Afghanistan. They had 100,000 troops, and they were chased out of Afghanistan. So we accept that we are there at the will of the people, and as long as the will of the people see that life is getting better, we can stay. And I would say that even the U.S. Army in Iraq, in the modern context, if the people don't want you to stay, you will go. Obviously, not in Iraq, they have much less support. But right now, the vast majority of the Afghan people want us to be there. We do not have, NATO does not have the combat power to stay in Afghanistan if we're not wanted. So we accept that. And to be able to stay there, we need to improve their lives. And I think this is where the concerns over our reaching out into things that look like humanitarian assistance come from. Our requirement to have the consent of the people.
MCC has avoided, it's a pacifist church organization, so we don't, aren't terribly comfortable working with the military. Anywhere, but also, just as important is that MCC is also very uncomfortable working closely with governments, with states. We're very careful about partner selection. We partner with churches, and even mosques, and we partner with NGOs that we know are operating independently. So, for example, in Iraq, we don't work with any of the NGOs that are tied in with the coalition. And a lot of the NGOs that don't come to us for funding or for help do so because they know that we're an NGO that's never taken the United States agency, the USAID, Agency for International Development, that we've never taken a dime from them anywhere in the world, let alone in Iraq. MCC has, I think, consistently over the last 15 years, or for longer than that, refused to work with the military. I mean, I get emails from commanders saying, we got an email last November while the Americans were in the process of destroying Fallujah, that we expect to have Fallujah pacified soon, and would you like to help with the reconstruction effort? And I don't know, did we respond to that? I don't even think we responded. But it's the sort of thing that just we in principle won't do and won't work with others to do.
The next question that was asked was whether or not the agencies share information with others, and if they have policies about it.
In general, it's speaking on behalf of MSF, it's not that we have, first of all, the general, then I get to maybe to the specific. In principle, we don't work with the military. I mean, I think that is clearly a principle, and it goes back to what humanitarian assistance is. But we're also much more pragmatic than that as well. So, I mean, I'd be, to be quite honest with you, can I actually sit here and say that we've never been evacuated on a military helicopter when all, when things have really gone wrong? I think of Liberia as an example, or being escorted out of a conflict zone where we just cannot stay any longer. Recently in Ivory Coast when, again, the situation deteriorated quite a bit. So yes, we have in the past relied upon the military, but clearly, any time that we have relied or utilized a military resource, we have gone through a process of thought and reflection. How is this going to be perceived by the public? In certain areas, in the context of a natural disaster, the concern of all the public, when there is not a conflict going on, there's less of a concern for the public. They just want to see an immediate response. And if the military has lift capacity, you utilize that lift capacity. But if you're in a conflict setting, then perception is everything. You can't say one day that we are independent and we don't take our orders from the military, we are apolitical, and the next day be working with them. Yes, we are pragmatic with it, and we do are very principled as well. In terms of information sharing, it's not our role. We don't want to be perceived as the eyes and ears of the military in the field. So we're very cautious of what information is shared, or even the perception that we share information. Of course, we would share information with other colleagues and other NGOs if there's a need for a food distribution or water and sanitation. Humanitarian needs, that type of information, we have an obligation to share. But we'd be very cognizant of not to be seen as sharing other information that would have a strategic military advantage for one side or another.
From our standpoint, if we agree to simply coexist in Afghanistan, which I think is what I would say, the military and MSF, for instance, the relationship is one more coexistence. The minimum that we would like to see shared is sort of what you look like, where you're operating, and very little more than that, because, in Afghanistan, we're conducting military operations. Ourselves and our coalition allies are conducting military operations. A lot of that happens in the evening. So from the military standpoint, we find it hard to accept criticism from an aid agency who absolutely refuses to tell us where they are. I accept that they don't have to tell us what they're doing, but you do have to tell us what you look like and where you are, from an absolute bare minimum. I think it behooves the organization to at least tell us that during the initial stages of the Afghan mission. The Red Cross kept putting their buildings under our bombs. It was a matter of we did not know where they were. The coalition did not know where they were. Now, it was a fault of our internal information, because they very clearly told us, but we did not get that information higher. So, from our standpoint, we have to know where the actors are to prevent
and like that. I used to, as I said, I was director for African communities in Christian Aid. I think I was the first colonial chicken to be appointed. So when we went to meet the other colleagues, they really thought I was out of place because I didn't look white and I had no intention of leaving either. But we sat down and then I introduced myself and they said they're welcome. But the food had already been cooked, as we say in Africa. They had already discussed and resolved on what to do. I began with a few other questions, because I was a new kid on the block, as they say. So I began asking, why are we doing humanitarian aid? Why don't we begin analyzing? Because this is my fundamental belief, that we should have hard-nosed political analysis, even if we don't use it in implementing our activities. We have to have a hard-nosed geopolitical and political analysis of the situation. We cannot operate in a vacuum. I should have begun by saying that. Second, I would have said the world we are in is a world of extremes. We talk about fundamentalism, we talk about militarism as increasing, and we talk about humanitarianism, okay? But it is being militarized increasingly, not less. So we are in a very difficult world. So if I appear a bit negative also, it's not for nothing, but just to harp on the fact that we are in extremely difficult period where there are no more good guys, bad guys, easily discernible. And so the language of the Second World War allies, especially that language which all NATO powers, including Canada, use, and then you begin to define, to ask yourself, so who are the allies? Or the language of the civilized countries of the world. You know, they just talk. Who are the others? Where are they? What is the link? Well, that is a very divisive language. And when we do humanity, if humanity is at the center of this, then we've got to do a hard-nosed critique of why we are calling others uncivilized, why we speak of allies, and who are these other enemies, since we're using Second World War. It's extremely serious. It's a language of extremes, and the world is not going to be easy to reckon with peace issues when you have increasing, not decreasing, even when it comes to
You have been listening to a discussion about the role of humanitarian aid in war-torn countries. My name is Bojan Dulabic, and you are listening to CKUW's The Beat, 95.9 FM Winnipeg.